KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The judge was the HR department. The judge was my boss. The judge was a colleague. He had all the power.
A new NPR investigation highlights problems with the way the courts police sexual harassment and bullying.
It's Monday, March 3rd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, a veteran diplomat says President Trump is rearranging the world order at shocking speed.
I'm used to empires or orders crumbling. I've never seen the country that created it and maintained it, dismantling it.
Also, stiff tariffs will take effect tomorrow on imports from Canada and Mexico. Hear how one business is preparing.
And we recap last night's Oscars, the winners, the losers, and one big onstage moment.
We live in a regime where I am free under civilian law, and Basil is under military laws that destroy his life and he cannot control. There is a different path.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Trump administration, in an apparent further effort to pressure Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, says it is pausing aid to Ukraine. That's according to a White House official speaking on background, who said the president has been clear he's focused on peace. We need our partners to be committed to that goal as well. We are pausing and reviewing our aid to ensure it's contributing to a solution. It comes just days after a disastrous meeting between President Trump and Zelensky. Europe, meanwhile, is working to forge a coalition to support Ukraine. President Trump is set to address a joint session of Congress and the nation tomorrow night in the first major address of his new term. NPR's Luke Garrett says security will be high.
Outside the U.S. Capitol, workers are installing anti-scale fencing, an added security measure for Trump's joint address, according to Capitol Police. Since returning to the White House, Trump has signed more than 75 executive orders aimed at reducing the federal government and securing the border, among other issues. Senior advisor Jason Miller told Fox News on Sunday that the president's speech will highlight his executive actions and push lawmakers to support his agenda.
That's going to be a big component, getting this one big, beautiful tax bill done. The House has already made some great steps. We need more money for the border to keep it permanently secure.
The president now needs Congress to approve new spending that supports his priorities by March 14th. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
A major investment by giant chipmaker Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company has been announced today by President Trump. The $100 billion investment in the U.S. promised over a four-year period. TSMC is the world's largest semiconductor maker and produces chips for Apple, Intel, and NVIDIA. Companies already announced plans to invest more than $65 billion in the U.S., including in three plants in Arizona, after receiving money under the Biden administration's CHIPS Act, which is designed to encourage domestic production of semiconductors. Linda McMahon, the billionaire and former professional wrestling exec, has been confirmed by the Senate to be the next U.S. Secretary of Education. NPR's Corey Turner has more.
McMahon's confirmation vote broke along party lines. At her confirmation hearing, she told lawmakers she would faithfully execute President Trump's plans to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education. The department notably provides funding to help schools serve two vulnerable student groups, those living in low-income neighborhoods and children with disabilities. McMahon told lawmakers she would not seek to cut that funding, but she would try to have responsibility for it moved to other federal agencies. In a recent NPR PBS News Marist poll, 63% of Americans polled said they opposed or strongly opposed getting rid of the Education Department. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Major sell-off to start the week on Wall Street as investors and business leaders worry about the ramifications of Trump administration tariffs. The Dow fell 649 points today. You're listening to NPR News. Israel is out with what it's calling a new ceasefire plan and is seeking to force Hamas militants to accept it by imposing a siege on the Gaza Strip. The plan is different from one the two sides agreed to in January. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the new proposal comes from U.S. President Trump's Mideast envoy, though the White House has yet to confirm that. The new plan would require Hamas to release half its remaining hostages in exchange for a ceasefire extension and a promise to negotiate a lasting truce. Preliminary results of a study tied to NPR's Stressless series shows a set of 8 skills can help to improve positive emotions and reduce anxiety. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
The thousands of people who signed up were offered the chance to practice a series of skills through an online course, including positive reappraisal, noticing positive events, and savoring them. One of the most striking findings is that participants' sense of self-efficacy increased, which means they started to believe more in their own ability to set a goal and accomplish it. Judy Moskowitz of Northwestern University, who developed the program and ran the study, says self-efficacy can go hand in hand with feeling more positive.
It's an upward spiral where you maybe take the first step. You feel some progress towards your goal.
And this can increase positive emotion, which can then help people take the next step. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices fell 2% today to a 12-week low on tariff worries, coupled with an announcement by OPEC plus Russia. The group intends to proceed with a planned oil output increase in April. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. People who work for the federal court system don't have the same kinds of job protections that most other Americans do. A nearly year-long NPR investigation has found problems with the way the courts police sexual harassment and bullying, and a pervasive culture of fear about blowing the whistle. A warning, this piece contains a description of sexual assault. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson reports.
In 2020, as the coronavirus pandemic began to shut things down, a recent law school graduate started a new job all the way across the country in Alaska. She accepted a coveted post as a law clerk for a federal judge.
It's kind of like a unicorn. It's a position that follows you for the rest of your life. It's on the top of your resume. It's, you know, people pay attention to it, especially a federal court clerkship.
The clerk hoped this job would jumpstart her career. She didn't know anyone else there, only the judge.
The judge was the HR department. The judge was my boss. The judge was a colleague. The judge was everything. He had all the power.
He started testing her boundaries early on.
It started immediately. The inappropriate conversations. There was a lot of talk, you know, about the judge's personal relationships, about sexual relationships.
She says she thought it was part of her job to listen to the judge and help him with anything. He was going through a divorce, and he began to text her constantly, to the point where her phone felt like an electric leash.
You know, I never had respite from being just a few text messages away from him. It was constant. It was during work. It was after work. It was all the time.
That pressure built. In the summer of 2022, things got worse.
That's when he told me he'd been communicating with this prosecutor that was appearing before him, and she had been sending nude photos, and that was the breaking point for me, where I decided I needed to leave.
She stayed in Alaska, but she got a new job as a federal prosecutor, and this, she hoped, would put an end to the ordeal. As it turned out, that was wrong. The voice you've been hearing is not her real voice, although they are her words verbatim. We're using a voice actor because she was too afraid to talk. You'll understand why in a moment. About a week after she left the judge's chamber, she ran into him at a party. I'm going to tell the next part of the story entirely from allegations in the court papers. That's in part because retelling it to me was too painful. At the party, he tried to get her to sit next to him on the couch. Eventually, she left, but she got a text from him saying he needed to talk to her. It was cold that night, so the judge suggested they chat inside his apartment. Once inside, the judge insisted she come to the bedroom. At first, she sat on the corner of the bed, but he wanted her to lay down. Then, she told investigators, he grabbed her breast. She tried to pull his arm off, but he was really strong. I just remember thinking, like, there's nothing I can do about this, she told the investigators. This is about to happen. Like, I always felt like this thing he could not touch, and finally, he felt like he could touch. A judge's control over the future of a young lawyer is real and lasting. With only a phone call, a judge can open doors to a lucrative job at a law firm or shut them permanently. And there's no one really policing what happens inside a judge's chambers beside the judge themselves. Judicial independence and protecting the balance of power give judges a tremendous amount of sway over workplace rules. For nearly a year, I interviewed 42 people, current and former workers within the federal court system, about their experience. They're men and women who work for more than two dozen judges, appointed by presidents from both major political parties. I heard from people whose self-confidence was shattered by judges who screamed so loudly, others could hear from the hallways. People who were fired after a week or two on the job for no clear reason. Some described sexual harassment, like in the case of the Alaska clerk. Many more shared episodes of bullying, and others said they faced discrimination because they had a disability or were pregnant. And things can get pretty tough for clerks who speak out. When the Alaska clerk reported the assault, she told a colleague who had been assigned to mentor her, but that mentor said she also had been coerced.
When I reported to my mentor, she was also the person that had been sending him nude photos and immediately told him that I reported the sexual assault.
Her mentor later said the judge's power and authority contributed to the pressure she felt, and he told her he would have sway over a job she wanted. The former clerk heard from friends the judge was furious, and when she ran into him, he warned her to keep her head down and shut up.
The actual sexual assault was awful. It was completely awful. And, you know, I've since sought therapy for that and help. But what happened next was almost worse.
The court system ultimately launched an investigation into the judge, Joshua Kindred. What followed were multiple rounds of interviews with investigators who cross-examined her and stress-tested her credibility. The court investigation took more than a year. All the while, two other young women clerks in the judge's chambers continue to work by his side. Then, in July...
Now, with the Ninth Circuit's report released just hours ago, we learned back in May that the judge was told he could face impeachment if he did not resign for what the counsel concluded was sexual misconduct with a clerk.
Judge Joshua Kindred told investigators that the sexual experience was consensual and that he had no, quote, sinister intent. The special committee found the judge deliberately lied when he said nothing sexual had happened between them. But the committee did not reach a conclusion about whether the judge sexually assaulted the former clerk, finding there was enough evidence to say the judge committed misconduct without even resolving that issue. Judge Kindred did not respond to NPR's attempts to reach him for comment. The clerk said she felt let down by the process.
I was sexually assaulted. I'm not sure why that was a fact in dispute. Perhaps not a fact in dispute, but not a conclusion drawn by the report. And I've never wavered on that fact, that was immediately what I reported to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
The federal judiciary points to the departure of the Alaska judge as a demonstration the system works. The Administrative Office of the Courts, which sets policy from Washington, says they've taken extensive steps to protect clerks and other workers since the Me Too movement swept the country in 2017. And they say they hold judges to the highest standards. But our investigation uncovered problems with the reporting system in the judicial branch. For one, there's a widespread culture of fear. And there's a good reason for that. Jamie Baker's a former judge who also worked in the White House and the military.
The location where I found the power differential the most distinct was when I was serving as a judge with law clerks. And I think that's something worth noting.
Not only is the relationship intense, it often comes with a huge age gap. Gabe Roth is executive director of Fix the Court. He's pushing the federal courts to be more accountable.
Judges are life tenured. The average age of federal judges right now is about 65 or 68. Law clerks, they are roughly, let's say, 26 to 30.
Another person pushing for change is Congresswoman Norma Torres, a Democrat from California.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to see all of you here.
Last fall, she convened a group of experts on the Hill to try to draw attention to the problem.
I don't need to be a lawyer to know that people in power with no oversight get to sweep people and problems under the rug.
Torres says the courts operate in a patchwork, so no one's in charge of overseeing all the systems that employees use to report misconduct. She's working alongside Georgia Congressman Hank Johnson.
Good morning. Pleasure to see you, sir.
Great to see you also. Thank you all for being here. You ready to go?
Okay.
Johnson's walking us through the Rayburn House office building and into the Capitol to introduce the Judiciary Accountability Act. His bill would make clear the same legal protections for workers in the private sector and the executive branch also apply to the 30,000 people who work for the federal courts.
This is just one small step, but a very important step to bring about some accountability.
The legislation did not get a hearing before Congress left town last year. The people who work for federal judges, for probation departments, for public defenders, they can't go to the executive branch for help. And it's not clear they can sue in courts either. Aliza Schatzman runs the Legal Accountability Project.
The federal judiciary is outrageously exempt from Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That means that if you are a law clerk and you are sexually harassed, fired, retaliated against by a federal judge, you have no legal recourse.
The federal courts say they've done a lot to make sure workers are treated with dignity and respect. But I've been told clerks who run into trouble on the job still face tremendous pressure to remain silent. A bad word from a judge can derail a clerk's career, while judges serve for life. I heard it again and again. Those judges who behave badly, often it's an open secret inside the courthouse, but nobody does anything about it. Many clerks graduated from top law schools and pride themselves on their smarts and resilience, only to break down in tears when they talk about hostile treatment they suffered working for federal judges. The judiciary protects its own, one clerk told me. Another said, I can handle a tough boss. I can't handle an abusive boss. I just wish more people would talk about it. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The U.S. is pausing its aid to Ukraine. That's according to a White House official who was not authorized to speak on the record. This news comes just days after a disastrous Oval Office meeting between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The White House's tone on the war has also changed, sounding more in line with Russia than with Ukraine. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is covering the story. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Ari.
So what's the White House saying about the aid?
Well, a senior White House official tells NPR that President Trump is pausing and reviewing Ukrainian military aid to, quote, ensure that it is contributing to a solution, saying that the president wants a peaceful solution. Now, of course, Ari, this all follows a contentious White House meeting between Zelensky and Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance about signing a deal that would give the U.S. the rights to critical minerals in Ukraine to basically, you know, pay back for the tens of billions in U.S. aid, even though much of that money has been spent in the U.S. on defense industries, such as building artillery shells for Ukraine. Zelensky kept asking at that meeting whether he would get security guarantees from the U.S. and whether they can trust Russia, and that seemed to anger Trump and Vance.
Tell us more about the nature of the security assistance and what pausing it would mean for the war.
Well, now we're talking about tens of billions of dollars again from late in the Biden administration, the latest tranche of aid that includes defensive missiles and munitions. Now, Ari, those missiles are key in preventing Russian missiles and drones from striking targets in Kyiv and elsewhere. And this war, let's face it, has been a stalemate for some time. Russia has been bloody, but so too has Ukraine. Neither side can win. But Ukraine supporters say, listen, if you put more pressure on Russia, whose economy is hurting and they have lost 700,000 casualties, you get a better deal for Ukraine at the negotiating table. That's always been the case. But it appears the Trump administration wants to end all this quickly and, frankly, more in Russia's favor.
Well, what about the role of Europe? Can they step into the void?
Well, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has talked about Europe pulling together to help Ukraine with weapons and money. He met over the weekend with Zelensky in a more positive setting. He talked about Great Britain, France, and other countries stepping up their efforts in a coalition of the willing, as he calls it, to hopefully involve the U.S. in their support for Ukraine. But you know, what's uncertain tonight is, will the U.S. provide any security guarantees, even if Zelensky signs off on that critical minerals deal with the U.S.? That was what gave Zelensky pause. Now, Keir Starmer said, quote, we are at a crossroads in history today, he said after the summit with Zelensky. And he said, we have to give strong support to Zelensky, and that European unity in an extremely high level we have not seen in quite some time. So this was a surprise, I guess, pulling the plug on U.S. aid to Ukraine. There was a number of months left in U.S. aid before the U.S. would have to decide whether more aid was going forward. But this is a surprise, and it's basically putting a lot more pressure on Zelensky.
NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, thank you.
You're welcome.
The 97th Academy Awards were handed out yesterday in Los Angeles. The ceremony was both an earnest celebration of the art of cinema and a gaudy tribute to Hollywood. Just you. And if you missed this year's Oscars, don't worry. Here to give us the night's biggest takeaways is NPR's resident pop culture expert and the host of Pop Culture Happy Hour, Linda Holmes. Hey, Linda.
Hello.
All right, Linda, I got to confess, I did miss the Oscars. You're going to need to catch me up a bit. Who was the big winner and who came up short?
So the big winner was Anora, an independent film about a sex worker who marries a former client and gets mixed up with a bunch of Russian oligarchs.
I love my husband.
You do not know this guy.
We are consenting adults.
If you think this is going to be allowed, you're dead wrong.
Do not touch me.
The film won Best Picture. The lead, Mikey Madison, won Best Actress, and the writer and director, Sean Baker, won for his direction, his script, and his editing. So a big, big night for that movie. Probably coming up short, you would say Emilia Perez, a Netflix film about a transgender cartel boss.
Soy Emilia Perez, una mujer mexicana, una mujer como las demás.
It had gotten 13 nominations. I think Netflix hoped it would win them their first Best Picture Oscar, but it lost a lot of steam over some offensive tweets that had resurfaced from the lead actress, Carla Sofia Gascon. And it ended up winning Best Supporting Actress for Zoe Saldana, Best Original Song, but it did not perform like Netflix hoped it would when it got all those nominations.
I understand that there was also a new host. How did Conan O'Brien do?
You know, Conan was good, I think. The more he settled into being his oddball self, the better he was. I think he won the crowd over as the night went on. You know, he had a little gag with what was supposedly a sandworm from Dune who was playing various musical instruments. It's the kind of thing he used to do as a late night host. It was fun to see that. But he also had a really nice and very funny moment with some LA firefighters. That's obviously in recognition and appreciation of their work on the fires in LA recently.
And finally, Pasadena Fire Department Captain Jody Slicker.
It's great to be back with Conan. Usually when he calls, he's stuck in a tree.
Okay.
And those fires did kind of recur a few times through the ceremony as a theme, as you would expect, because when something important is in the news, it often will show up in the Oscars.
Yeah, so I'm curious, were there other times when current events kind of broke their way into the ceremony or were brought up by people on stage?
Well, probably the biggest had to do with the documentary feature winner, which was a film called No Other Land, which is made by a team of Israeli and Palestinian filmmakers, and it's about the destruction of Palestinian communities in the West Bank. That team spoke really passionately on stage about the crisis that the film is covering.
We live in a regime where I am free under civilian law, and Bassel is under military laws that destroy his life and he cannot control. There is a different path, a political solution, without ethnic supremacy, with national rights for both of our people.
And he went on to say that U.S. foreign policy is worsening the conditions that the film is talking about. That got applause from the audience. Interestingly, that film still does not have U.S. distribution, presumably because of the subject matter. We will have to see if that changes. But yeah, that was about it for sort of current events. Conan O'Brien had sort of one Donald Trump joke, and that's about it.
Interesting. Okay, so just like big picture, how would you sum up last night's show? Just as a watcher, how was it?
Well, I really enjoyed it, actually. It was a pretty earnest and talky ceremony. In some of the categories, they gave the presenters time to talk individually about nominees. There were some nice moments that came from that. The ceremony is always too long. It's always somewhat self-indulgent by nature. But I do think on the whole, it had an intimacy to it that is sometimes missing from a more efficient, you might say, or a splashier ceremony. So I actually enjoyed it.
That is NPR's Linda Holmes. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Juana.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's third novel, Americana, made a splash when it appeared in 2013. Then life happened. Children were born, parents died. Fiction writing seemed to stop, until now.
Having finally finished a novel feels as though I am reunited with myself.
Hear about her new novel, Dream Count, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is caught between President Trump's desire to end the war in Gaza and political partners who want to see it continue.
A large part of Israelis will say that what Bibi cares about above all is staying in power. And by staying in power, maintaining his coalition and staying on the good side of Donald Trump.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Trump tonight ordered a pause on aid to Ukraine. A White House official says the aid is being reviewed to assure that it's making a contribution to a peaceful outcome in the Ukraine-Russia war. The U.S. this week is levying new tariffs on goods from Canada and Mexico. An additional 10% tariff will be charged on goods from China. President Trump made the announcement at the White House Oval Office.
Tomorrow, tariffs 25% on Canada and 25% on Mexico, and that'll start. So they're going to have a tariff. So what they have to do is build their car plants, frankly, and other things in the United States.
The president spoke at the White House during an event with the head of Taiwan's semiconductor manufacturing company. The business announced it plans to spend an additional $100 billion on semiconductors in the U.S. As a West Texas measles outbreak spreads, infectious disease experts reiterate the best defense is still vaccination. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
Measles is so contagious that if no one is vaccinated, one infected person can spread it to 18 others. By contrast, when at least 95% of a community is vaccinated, a sick person will be able to infect less than one other person on average, and an outbreak will die out. In Gaines County, Texas, the epicenter of the current outbreak, just under 82% of kindergartners are vaccinated. At that rate, one sick person could infect an average of three other unvaccinated people. Experts say high vaccination rates in Texas as a whole make it unlikely that the current outbreak will grow to include thousands of cases. But if vaccination rates continue to plummet, we could see more widespread infections in the next 5 to 10 years. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Wall Street ended the day in negative territory, the Dow down 649 points. This is NPR News in Washington. People around the world are glued to a live stream of two beloved eagles in a nest in the mountains east of Los Angeles. Viewers are waiting to see if the eagles' eggs will hatch this year. Madison Aument of member station KVCR reports.
Eagles Jackie and Shadow have attracted a devoted following over the years as a camera high in a pine tree overlooking Big Bear Lake has streamed their antics 24/7. In January, Jackie laid three eggs. Now, two have started to pip, the process when the eaglets begin to poke through their shells. Sandy Steers runs the live stream. She has her fingers crossed that the eaglets will emerge soon.
It's definitely much higher probability once they hit, and especially the one that's so active and seeing it moving and everything.
Last year ended in heartbreak for viewers when none of Jackie's three eggs hatched. Steer says the hatching process can take about 3 days. She says if the eaglets make it this time, local third graders will get to pick their names. For NPR News, I'm Madison Aument.
Linda McMahon has won Senate confirmation to serve as the nation's Secretary of Education. The vote was 51 to 45. President Trump has said that her job will essentially be to preside over the dismantling of the department. At her confirmation hearings, the 76-year-old billionaire and former head of World Wrestling Entertainment said she'd focus on efficiency. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. After he was kicked out of the White House on Friday afternoon, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky went to London, where leaders welcomed him much more warmly.
Our starting point must be to put Ukraine in the strongest possible position now, so that they can negotiate from a position of strength. And we are doubling down in our support.
That was British Prime Minister Keir Starmer yesterday. He and French President Emmanuel Macron, along with nearly 20 other world leaders, met to discuss a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Trump administration seems to continue aligning itself more with Moscow. To talk about where things go and what this means for U.S. alliances, Richard Haass is with us. He's President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations and has served in diplomatic roles in Republican presidential administrations. Good to have you back.
Good to be with you, Ari.
You know, President Trump's been saying for almost a decade since his first run for office that the rest of the world should take more responsibility for global security. Whatever you may think of his tactics, is he succeeding at least at getting American allies to do more?
He might be, but at enormous cost. It's one thing to say the rest of the world needs to do more and let's plan, say, a 10-year transition, which is orderly, where we dial up the rest of the world and say dial down the United States so our foes are not encouraged and so our allies are not unnerved. But this is not that. This is much more of a switch than a dial. And the danger is that you have opportunities where adversaries see the reason to attack. You see some of our friends saying either we have to appease a powerful neighbor or maybe we need nuclear weapons of our own. So there's a chance that some good will come of this. I don't deny that. The Europeans might actually do more, and they should do more with their conventional military forces. But this is highly disruptive and comes at great risk.
Do you think the Europeans can figure out how to end this war without U.S. leadership?
Extraordinarily difficult. The Europeans can only do so much. They don't have the defense industries. They don't have the large inventories to transfer. But Ukraine can hold on. The problem is without the United States supporting Ukraine, and I think that's likely the way we're heading, it's quite probable that Vladimir Putin will not have the incentive to compromise, to accept a ceasefire, except on terms that are quite draconian.
Oh, so you're saying Russia could make real advances in Ukraine if the U.S. pulls back, and that would disincentivize any kind of peace talks?
Right, and that's what's missing. I don't understand about the president's approach. He says he wants to be a peacemaker here. Well, the best way to get a peace is to persuade Vladimir Putin that the United States and the West will stand by Ukraine, so continued war by Russia will not lead Mr. Putin to anything that resembles success. We've done just the opposite. We have now essentially said we're going to shut down American support for Ukraine, so Vladimir Putin sitting in the Kremlin going, why should I compromise?
What about the argument that Trump is effectively saying the quiet part out loud, that Ukraine cannot win this war even with U.S. support, so it's time to just bring the conflict to an end?
If by win this war you mean recover all of its territory going back to 1991, you're right. And that was actually a good strategic insight of this administration, that militarily recovering all Ukraine had lost in 2014 and 2022 was not realistic. And the Biden administration refused to do that. But the other way to define success is you have a ceasefire. Ukraine keeps what it has now, which is 80% of its territory. The war stops. And then you have the ability over years or decades to negotiate. And maybe you come up with a new relationship between Ukraine and, say, a post-Vladimir Putin Russia. So again, I think there's all sorts of possibilities. But success should not be defined either as Ukraine recovering all of its territory militarily. That's a non-starter. Or giving Vladimir Putin everything he wants.
I'd like to get your take on what the big picture set of U.S. alliances right now looks like. Because since the end of World War II, the globe has been more or less defined by a certain set of expectations. And those alliances seem very shaky right now. Trump last week said at his cabinet meeting that the European Union, quote, was formed in order to screw the United States. To put it bluntly, is the post-war order done?
To put it bluntly, the post-war order is on life support. It's a tragedy. I've never seen this before in history. I'm used to empires or orders crumbling. I'm used to them being overwhelmed. I've never seen the side, the country that created it and maintained it, dismantling it. And that is exactly what we are doing. And what's so tragic about it is the great strategic advantage of American foreign policy is we wake up every morning and we have this pool of partners, dozens in Europe and in Asia, that are willing to work with us militarily to deter conflict, to fight them if need be, willing to trade with us, invest with us, and so forth. And we are undermining that, and for nothing that's necessarily good or even in any way comparable in return.
Well, what's the alternative? What comes after that?
Could be a world of much more disorder, where adversaries see opportunities. Could be a world of spheres of influence, where China says, oh, we're going to do with Taiwan and others what we want, where Russia controls big parts of Europe, where the United States, consistent with some of what the president has said, seems to play a more aggressive role in the Western Hemisphere. So that's possible, too. The problem is any one of those worlds has far more conflict to it, far less prosperity, and far less freedom. So I just don't understand why we would trade in an approach to the world that has worked for 80 years for something that's far more risky and potentially far more costly.
So we began this conversation with discussion about foes, allies, adversaries, all terms that you used. Do those terms even apply anymore?
It's not a question I ever expected to get, but here we are. No, I think one of the things that's happened is that allies have lost, under this administration, their special place. The fact that they are dependent on us for security, the fact that they trade with us, has actually become sources of leverage on the part of the United States. So being an ally, in many ways, has become something of a liability. That's why, again, you'll see certain allies trying to become more self-sufficient. Some may actually think they need nuclear weapons to become really safe. Others may say, wow, we have to appease a China or a Russia because we can't count on the United States anymore. But no, I think you're right. The basic point is that allies of the United States no longer feel they are in an advantage position, and they are going to be casting about for alternatives.
You watched the Trump campaign closely. You follow foreign affairs closely. Are you surprised by this 1 month into the new administration?
In a word, I'm very surprised by what I'm seeing. You know, I followed closely President Trump's first term, which, while something of a departure, was still on the playing field. Trump 2.0 is qualitatively different. It's far more radical. I would never use the word conservative. It's the opposite of conservative, because rather than conserving, it is disrupting. And we see all these alliance relationships being disrupted. We see, in sometimes now, an unconditional reaching out to adversaries like Russia. And what we don't see is what the president proposes to put in place of the existing order. It seems to be a world, if you will, without structure, without permanent relationships. And it's not something that was talked about during the campaign. And I think when people went to the polls, this is not what they voted for. It's not what they bargained for, but it is what they're getting.
Richard Haass is president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's author of the weekly Substack newsletter, Home and Away. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
After we recorded that conversation, a White House official told NPR that President Trump had paused all aid to Ukraine, quote, to ensure that it is contributing to a solution.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
President Trump said this afternoon that steep tariffs will take effect tomorrow on imports from Canada and Mexico. Trump declared there's no room left for an 11th-hour deal like the one he made a month ago to postpone the tariffs. That announcement sent the stock market tumbling, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling nearly 650 points. NPR's Scott Horsley spoke with one business owner who's been wrestling with tariff whiplash.
Randy Carr runs a company based in Florida that makes embroidered patches, the kind you might see on a delivery person's uniform or a baseball cap.
Customers range from Little League and Junior League sports, the military, workwear like UPS and FedEx drivers, to promotional products.
Carr has factories in Texas and Georgia to allow for speedy delivery. But 20 years ago, he opened a plant in Mexico, where most of the labor-intensive work is done. Since then, the company has grown on both sides of the border.
We now have 500 people in the States and 880 in Mexico. So by moving to Mexico, we were able to grow that much more in the States also.
Now that growth is facing a serious challenge. President Trump has ordered a 25% tariff on all imports from Mexico. I asked Carr if he'll try to pass the cost of that import tax onto his customers by raising prices.
The easy answer is yes, but that doesn't mean that people are going to take the tariff and pay the bill. So the long and short of it is probably what's going to happen is that it'll be a mixed bag.
Some of the import tax will be passed along to customers, but some will come out of Carr's own budget. As a result, he's postponed a planned investment in new equipment for the Texas and Georgia factories, which would have allowed for more domestic manufacturing.
Once I get a clearer picture of what's going to happen with the tariffs, then we'll reassess where we go with that. But everything's been shelved for now.
A lot of factories are in similar limbo. One manufacturing manager surveyed by the Institute for Supply Management likened forecasting in this environment to a wild guess. Another warned that customers are pausing orders because of uncertainty over the looming import taxes. Trump has also threatened to impose tariffs on imported steel, aluminum, and a wide variety of other products. Christine McDaniel, who tracks trade policy at the Mercatus Center, says up until today, financial markets were betting that Trump would use those tariffs as a bargaining chip to extract other concessions, and that most of the import taxes would not actually take effect.
So far, the markets have not seemed to be freaked out by this. They're looking and they're saying Trump is making deals. And that's going to be great until it no longer is the case.
Randy Carr is not taking any chances. Because of rising costs in Mexico, he was already scouting a new factory location in the Dominican Republic. He says Trump's tariff threat just accelerated that move.
That was a kick for us to say, all right, like, we need to deal with this now. We can't wait. Regardless of whether it happens in a month from now or not, we are not going to sit and be a victim of this. So that's the move.
The new factory should be up and running by November. Carr knows Trump could slap tariffs on imports from the Dominican Republic as well, but for now he's hoping that country's small enough to avoid becoming a target. Like any business person, Carr says he's used to adjusting to changing circumstances, but ever since Trump returned to the White House, the changes have been dizzying. The tariff threat against Mexican imports was on one day, off the next, then on again within the space of 48 hours.
We're planning like it's going to happen. The issue is, while we're planning while it's going to happen, we're not running the business. We're not taking care of our customers. I'm not taking care of my employees. I'm taking care of a what-if scenario on tariffs.
And that whiplash of what-ifs shows no signs of easing. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in a bind. On the one hand, President Trump wants the Gaza ceasefire to continue. On the other, Netanyahu's most important political partner is encouraging him to renew the war. And as NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports, the stakes couldn't be higher.
At a funeral procession for Israeli hostages killed in Gaza, one Israeli onlooker blames her country's leaders for prolonging the agony of those still captive there.
All of the people who were in this government, they should be in prison.
Sarit Shaiman says Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has one job.
You're in charge. Fix it.
Fix it. Bring back the remaining hostages from Gaza. But that means extending a ceasefire with Hamas, something Netanyahu's far-right coalition partners oppose. Analysts say that the way Netanyahu is trying to solve Israel's current crisis reflects the way he sees himself. Michael Oren is a former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. He served under Netanyahu.
He has a transformative role. He was born to accomplish something very specific, which was to save the state of Israel, and believes that nobody else is better qualified to do that.
Oren says that while Netanyahu is often viewed abroad as militaristic and even a warmonger, at home many see him as indecisive and conflict-averse. But after the shock of the Hamas attack of October 7, 2023, Oren says Israelis feel like they have no other choice than the elder statesman, who is Israel's longest-serving prime minister.
I hear this again and again. You know, I can't stand him, but he's the only one who can stand up to pressures.
And the pressures are great for Netanyahu, whose nickname is Bibi.
A large part of Israelis will say that what Bibi cares about above all is staying in power, and by staying in power, maintaining his coalition, and staying on the good side of Donald Trump.
Nadav Stauchler, a former advisor to the prime minister, has a name for this bind.
I would call it the Bibi sandwich.
Netanyahu's ability to stay in power faces a threat, spearheaded by far-right finance minister Bezalel Smotrich. He's a religious Jewish ultra-nationalist and ideologue. Smotrich wants the war to continue in Gaza to eradicate Hamas. He's also called for Israel to settle Gaza.
Kodem kol, anachnu nishaarnu bamemshala, kedei levade shechozrim leilachem.
Smotrich says he's been promised to renew the war on Hamas. Otherwise, he will quit the government, collapsing Netanyahu's coalition. Like many politicians in the game, as long as Netanyahu, he's made political enemies, says former Ambassador Oren.
What he has done is eliminate political rivals, especially with his own party.
Oren says Netanyahu must now rely on his loyalists to stay in power, the far right and ultra-religious. That puts Netanyahu in a difficult position as he contemplates extending the ceasefire to a second phase. Former Netanyahu advisor Stauchler.
He understands that if he goes to phase two, as we know it, to finish the war, this is something that might finish his coalition.
And Stauchler says Netanyahu needs to keep his coalition intact if he wants to achieve his ultimate goals.
Eliminate the Iranian threat. Netanyahu wants to bring another peace agreement with Saudi Arabia. His legacy is at stake.
And on the other hand, Oren says Netanyahu needs to keep President Donald Trump happy.
Donald Trump appreciates loyalty. Bibi and his government, the state of Israel, are loyal. It is vital. It's vital for something as basic as ammunition supplies.
Trump has said he will defer to whatever Israel wants to do once the first phase of the deal is over. But he signaled that he wants an end to the war and a return of all the hostages. So what main principle will guide Netanyahu in deciding which direction to take? Alon Pinkas is a former Israeli diplomat who served under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Shimon Peres. He says Netanyahu is after one thing.
He's worried about political survival.
Netanyahu is currently on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. If convicted, he could face prison.
He has no political life expectancy outside the prime minister's office.
That bleak future would be in stark contrast to the vision he set out for himself during an interview in 2017 when he was asked,
"What's the legacy? This is what I left behind."
Netanyahu did not hesitate.
The protector of Israel.
He said, in this region, the weak don't survive.
What I want to do is safeguard and ensure the future of Israel.
A future of Israel in which he's always leader. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
It's been a long, hard winter in much of the U.S., which is a bummer if you hate scraping ice off your car windows in the morning. But for people like NPR's Brian Mann, who loves snow, winter is a playground. Brian sent this audio postcard from New York's Adirondack Mountains.
It is a classically cold winter day, 19 degrees. The woods are frosted with snow, and it's deep. I'm on my snowshoes.
I'm bundled up from head to toe, which means I'm warm. One thing I love about winter hiking is with the right boots and layers of clothes, you can feel cozy, really comfortable, exploring places like this.
The trail's taking me along the edge of a cliff, and there are cascades of ice, bright yellow, some of it kind of a glowing blue.
I'm not alone out here. Every half hour or so, a flock of chickadees swirls around me. They seem curious, some so brave they almost settle on my outstretched glove. I hike on. There are patches of blue sky through the trees and big sweeps of sunshine on the snow. It's cold, though. My breath freezes in my beard.
And now I've snowshoed up over a ridge, and I'm descending into a valley that is just completely solitary and wild, and the result is just this feeling of really deep winter, and it's really still.
A woodpecker drums in the high tree canopy. The sound makes the forest seem vast.
Now I've pushed beyond where anybody else has gone. That means that I'm breaking trail, kind of wading through snow that's up to my knees, sometimes up to my waist.
I come to the edge of a frozen lake called Wolf Pond. There's still running water here, a little river that flows under the ice, breaking over black rocks.
You can hear that different sound in my snowshoes. That's because I'm out on the ice now, on this wild mountain pond.
Big mountains rise on the horizon, glacial and white. The sky is smoky with clouds, and as I stop to rest and drink black coffee from my thermos, the snow starts to fall again. Big flakes bright against the winter woods. Brian Mann, NPR News, in New York's Adirondack Mountains.
Warming waters off New England's coast are bringing in new fish and new opportunities for the fishing industry, but climate change is happening so fast that regulators can't keep up.
My biggest worry is losing the industry. We can't wait a decade because there won't be New England fishing industries left anymore.
That's tomorrow. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the...
All my boyfriends have gone away, but there's one fella who is here to stay. He's a 4F papa, but he's got one A idea. He's a 4F papa, and he's been that way for years. He's too old for the army, too cold for the navy, staying home trying to sop up all the gravy. He's a 4F papa, but he's got one A idea. Every single day he's out on the hunt. He'd like to do some fighting on any old front. The girls say no, no, he's got no vim. It's better to do without than to do with him. He's a 4F papa, but he's got one A idea. Night after night he's becoming a bore. 62 missions and still no score. He